This is not just a professional failing. This is a failing of basic humanity toward another individual. This incident was heinous, reckless, and inhumane. I expect you to feel what the Nichols family feels. I expect you to feel outrage in the disregard of basic human rights, as our police officers have taken an oath to do the opposite of what transpired on the video.
The Memphis police chief warns the public ahead of today's release of body cam video and the death of Tyree Nichols, asking the community to protest peacefully. We'll have the latest in that extremely disturbing case. Plus, it was supposed to be the investigation that would finally expose the deep state plot against Donald Trump. Only it didn't find anything, and it cost taxpayers millions of dollars. We'll have more on that. And President Joe Biden slams House Republicans for what he calls a MAGA economic plan. We'll play for you his comments on that and the overall health of the economy. We'll talk about it as it comes as the president is considering a trip overseas to mark a year of war in Eastern Europe. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Friday, January 27th with Willie and me. We have the host of Way Too Early, White House Bureau Chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire, and Pulitzer Prize winning columnist at The Washington Post, Eugene Robinson. And Joe, this morning, you are reporting from outside the site of what was the Auschwitz concentration camp to mark International Holocaust Remembrance Day. We want to remember the terror, the torture, the lives lost there, but also how it all started. Joe?
Well, it is noon here at Auschwitz on this commemoration day. And, you know, Mika, in the age of social media and 24/7 news channels, we've become accustomed to the daily barrage of grim news reports and depressing stories from Uvalde to Ukraine. Conditioned to compartmentalize, we somehow digest the bad news and move on throughout the day. But for anybody who has set foot on the grounds of the Auschwitz death camp, there is no compartmentalizing of emotions. There is no moving on throughout the day. And there's no grasping the unparalleled evil that happened here and culminating in the systemic slaughter of 6 million Jews. How exactly does one comprehend how a country, an army, a single person perform such daily depraved acts on other human beings? And how the scale of these evil actions led to 6 million deaths? It's impossible. We simply cannot. But history does provide an understanding of how such horrors began. It began with a lie, and then more lies, and then the big lie. And in this tragic case, the lie was that Jews lost the First World War for Germany. These lies spread all too easily among Germans and led to Jewish homes and businesses being vandalized, led to Jews being singled out in those businesses and in schools, and led to a permissive attitude toward creeping anti-Semitism until the lies and the stigmatism of Jews led step by step by step to deportations, to executions, and to extermination. This first chapter of the Holocaust against the Jewish people is why we're here, to remind ourselves that anti-Semitism can never be allowed to find safe harbor again in polite society, whether on elite college campuses, on social media platforms, or in country clubs with former presidents. Passive acceptance invites violence. Holocaust survivor and Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal warned that, quote, violence is like a weed. It does not die even in the greatest drought. And he warned President Carter in the White House in 1980 that Hitler and Stalin are alive today. They are waiting for us to forget because in forgetting, we make possible the resurrection of these monsters. So it is that on these grounds, in this gathering today, this Holocaust Museum bears daily witness to what happened here and across Europe not so long ago. Mr. Wiesenthal wrote at the end of his life that his entire life of hunting down Nazis was driven by a singular focus: to send a warning to the murderers of tomorrow. You will never rest. And neither should we. Never rest. Never forget. Willie?
And as you say, Joe, these issues and anti-Semitism newly resident right now. President Biden is vowing to keep up efforts to stamp out anti-Semitism in the United States. In a statement on this day, the president writes in part, "Sadly, we have seen over and over again that hate never goes away. It only hides, waiting to reemerge whenever it is given just a little bit of oxygen. And today, across our country, we are seeing swastikas on cars, anti-Semitic banners on bridges, verbal and physical attacks against Jewish businesses and Jewish Americans, even Holocaust denialism." The president continued, "On International Holocaust Remembrance Day and every day, the United States stands with Holocaust victims, their families, and their descendants. We remember. We honor their stories. We will face down the hate and the lies that carry in them the terrifying echoes of one of the worst chapters in human history." And Joe, you've been in Warsaw now for a couple of days. I know you were in the Warsaw ghetto yesterday, got a sense of the place. Now standing outside of Auschwitz, I'm just curious, what does it feel to be there, particularly on this day?
Well, you know, not so long ago, I think it would have felt almost like ancient history. It just simply does not now, in part because the specter of war hangs over the people of Warsaw, the people of Poland, the people of Eastern Europe. They are seeing to the east of them a war that resembles World War One, World War Two, and it's always present in their minds. They've accepted millions of refugees into their country, millions of refugees into their homes, and anti-Semitism in Europe, across America, far more pronounced, far more public than it's been in quite some time. There's, you know, Willie, we've always seen creeping anti-Semitism across Europe and across our country, but it has become far too prevalent of late, whether it's been with extremely popular music stars, whether it's been with social media sites, inviting neo-Nazis back on to their platform, whether it's been ex-presidents inviting neo-Nazis into their home, into their clubs. It's become far more prevalent. That gives permission. That gives permission and invites a permissive attitude towards anti-Semitism that leads to far too many acts of anti-Semitism taking place across this country. My one of my children called earlier this week and talked about how a friend's dorm room, the door of the dorm room, a Jewish girl, had a swastika put on it earlier this week. And multiply that out hundreds of times, thousands of times a week, a month. And we see, again, we must never rest. We must never forget. And you just can't being here. It is remarkable. And it is a reminder. Willie, the thing that I just haven't been able to grasp, and I don't think anybody can grasp, is the totality of this evil. But again, by focusing on how it began in Germany in 1933, 1934, 1935, we can see the warning signs for our country, the warning signs for the rest of the world.
Well, the perils that we face today, part of the reason why you are there right now, Joe, give us a sense of what else we can expect to see in the 4 hours to come on Morning Joe. I understand you'll be talking to the second gentleman, Doug Emhoff.
Yeah, the second gentleman is here. He has toured. He's taken a tour of Auschwitz already this morning. He is touring the area throughout the day and going to a service that happens every year, a commemorative service. You saw a picture of him there with your brother, Ambassador Mark Brzezinski, who of course comes to this event now every year. And This is very personal for Doug for so many reasons, but he's going to be spending time here, and it's going to also go to an ancestral home here, a family of his, a Jewish family of his who lived here throughout the war. So I'll be talking to Doug Imhoff, the second gentleman, later on this morning, and we'll have that for you.
Joe, we'll look forward to that conversation coming up in just a little bit, and we'll see much more of you throughout the morning. Mika, for people wondering about this day and why we mark this day, Holocaust Remembrance Day, it is January 27th, 1945, when the Red Army, the Soviets, made their way through Warsaw to Auschwitz and began the liberation on this day of Auschwitz. And of course, those soldiers were horrified by the scope of the horror they saw. And this is the day when it just first began to dawn on the world, first those soldiers and then the world, the depth of the horror of the Holocaust.
Yeah, we'll be speaking with Joe throughout the show, and also enjoy his interview with Doug Imhoff, with it's incredibly personal for Doug as well, and we'll have that story as well. We're going to get to news here at home now. Five former police officers have now been charged with murder in the death of 29-year-old Tyre Nichols. This is the city of Memphis prepares to release video showing the incident that led to Nichols' death. NBC News correspondent Priscilla Thompson has more.
Five former Memphis police officers have been charged with second-degree murder in the deadly arrest of 29-year-old Tyre Nichols.
While each of the five individuals played a different role in the incident in question, the actions of all of them resulted in the death of Tyre Nichols, and they are all responsible.
All five officers also charged with aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping, and official misconduct charges.
What happened here does not at all reflect proper policing. This was wrong. This was criminal.
The announcement comes amid rising tension.
He was a human piñata for those police officers. It was an unadulterated, unabashed, nonstop beating of this young boy for 3 minutes.
Oh my God.
Tyre's mother, heartbroken. Her son was a dad and loved to skateboard.
You all had an opportunity to view this video.
I watched about a minute of it, but I couldn't. Once I heard my son say, "What did I do?" I lost it, and I couldn't.
Police say they stopped Nichols for reckless driving on January 7th, and that two confrontations ensued, after which Nichols complained of shortness of breath. He was taken to the hospital in critical condition and died 3 days later.
We're better than this. We're better than the egregious conduct and actions of those police officers.
Nearly 2 weeks after the incident, all five officers were fired after an internal investigation found they violated multiple department policies, including excessive use of force, duty to intervene, and duty to render aid. The attorneys representing two of the officers saying their clients plan on pleading not guilty.
No one out there that night intended for Tyre Nichols to die. No one.
Two Memphis Fire Department personnel who helped care for Nichols have also been relieved of duty, pending an investigation, the department says. The Shelby County District Attorney's Office, the FBI, and Department of Justice are all now investigating.
All right. Eugene Robinson, I don't even know where to begin with this. This video is must be absolutely horrendous. If you look at the chain of events where this happens, he dies, they're immediately fired after an internal investigation, but the video doesn't get released. I don't even know where to begin. This is policing. This is the rise of violence in our society. We had experts on our show earlier this week saying they've seen people solving problems with guns more than ever before. The epidemic is exploding, except in this case, was he even armed?
Not that we know of. There's a lot we don't know about this incident, except that Tyre Nichols is dead, and that apparently he was beaten to death by these officers. And it's how many times have we told the story? It is exhausting and sad and infuriating to have to tell it again. He stopped in a traffic violation, and he ends up dead. You are right that given what we're hearing about this video, it must be awful. 3 minutes is a long, long time when someone is being pummeled literally to death, and it's going to be. People are going to be outraged, I think, when they see it. And I will be outraged when I see it. We have been working on these issues for a long time, and we have to continue, obviously, because the culture inside many police departments still has not changed. It's not changed to the understanding that policing is something you do with a community, not to a community, not to the citizens of your city or your county. It's something you do with them, and that message has to get through. It is a tragedy that this is the way that message gets reinforced again and again and again through deaths like this one.
Gene, sometimes in cases like this, we see a circling of the wagons among police officers around the officers involved. Mm-hmm. We just haven't seen that. In fact, the Memphis chief of police yesterday called this heinous, reckless, inhumane, horrific. It gives you some window. We saw the reaction from the poor man's mother of what's actually in this video, which we expect to be released sometime soon, perhaps later today. But this is a case, it seems, just listening to the reaction of the officers themselves or the reaction of the chief of police in Memphis, a clear-cut, heinous beating by police officers. And we may see that later today.
We may see that later today. And you bring up a really good issue, which is that administrators of police departments, chiefs and the top level of administration in many police departments, or at least in some, has changed its attitudes and in fact looks at policing in a different way. But getting that culture, pushing it down through the ranks, pushing it out onto the streets, is a real challenge for any police chief. And so there is this disconnect quite often, and we've seen it in other cases as well, between police chiefs who have an understanding of their role and the role of police that you or I might share, and officers on the street who have a different understanding and who are resistant to change and who still have the kind of Fort Apache mentality of us versus them that leads to this sort of tragedy.
And seemingly unarmed, killed at the hands of police officers. But what has been striking about this one, Mika, and people we've been talking to, is this video, that it is so tough to watch, that it led to the immediate firing of these officers, the immediate criminal charges put up against officers, charged with murder, and real concerns about what may happen once it becomes public. We heard from President Biden yesterday putting out a statement saying that, of course, he grieved with the family, and he said that, of course, the Department of Justice and state authorities are continuing the work. And he says that I joined Tyre's family in calling for peaceful protest. Outrage is understandable, but violence is never acceptable. To have almost a pre-buttal from the president shows the degree of concern as to what may happen today. Also, they've added additional security at the U.S. Capitol today because of protests that are expected to be held there later on after that video is released. It's going to be a tough moment for the country, when we see this. And we certainly, as the president said, understand anger, but hope it doesn't spill into violence. But law enforcement officials are preparing that it may.
All right. Still ahead on Morning Joe, Mitch McConnell's wife, former Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, is out with a rare rebuke of Donald Trump, and she's not the only past administration official criticizing the former president. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton is calling Trump's 2024 campaign poison for Republicans. We'll take a look at those new comments, plus the must-read opinion pages, including one new piece entitled Trump Has Completely Lost His Grip on Reality. We'll read from that. Also ahead, Congressman Adam Schiff is our guest. He joins us on the heels of announcing a Senate run for Dianne Feinstein's seat. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Daylight feels like it's a long way.
NBC News is reporting this morning President Biden is weighing a trip to Europe next month to coincide with the one-year mark of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. American officials say no final decision has been made, but a number of countries are being considered for the visit, including Poland. The White House reportedly is exploring ways the president can recognize the one-year anniversary of the war. One idea is for the president to deliver a speech while in Europe, emphasizing the need for the U.S. and its allies to remain united going forward. Should the president end up going to Europe, a person familiar with the discussions tells NBC News one goal would be to create a moment as symbolically meaningful as when Ukrainian President Zelensky visited the U.S. in December when he addressed Congress as well. Jonathan Lemire, what more do we know about this potential trip by the president?
Yeah, I was talking to White House aides about this last night. Trip's not locked in. It may not happen, but they're at least exploring the idea of late February, the president heading to Europe, likely Eastern Europe, potentially Poland again, which is where he was last year, soon after the war began. Another possibility would be Brussels, the headquarters to NATO, because, of course, he has really reinvigorated that alliance in its response to Moscow's invasion. It's going to be a year of a lot of international travel for the president. He also hopes to head back to Europe this summer when Finland and Sweden officially become members of NATO to mark that as well. But yes, this is a reflection of this White House's realization that they need to keep the focus on this conflict. Now about to hit the year mark, they want to keep people focused on it. They want to be able to keep the money flowing to Ukraine. We know the tanks went there this week. There's concerns that Republicans later this year in Congress will block additional funding. They want to keep the awareness here in the States, but also in Europe, saying, look, we're with you. We haven't forgotten you. We need to stay the course in supporting Ukraine. And a big moment like this that would attract a lot of media attention would go to that, as our plans also not finalized, Mika, potentially for President Zelensky of Ukraine to come here to the United States and to address the United Nations in a few weeks around the one-year mark of the invasion as well.
Wow. All right. And just this side note, former President Trump commented on his social media platform yesterday about the Biden administration's decisions to send tanks to Ukraine. Trump wrote in one post, first come the tanks, then come the nukes. Get this crazy war ended now. So easy to do. Sounds so much like Vladimir Putin. And also, I remember he asked a lot of questions really early on about using nukes and whether or not he could use them. In a later post, he wrote in all caps, if I were president, the Russia-Ukraine war would never have happened. But even now, if president, I would be able to negotiate an end to this horrible and rapidly. Okay. You know what? Somebody's reporting that he's losing his grip on reality. We'll get to that in a moment. He's also losing his top supporters, people who do know a little bit about foreign policy. In an interview with CBS News, Trump's one-time former national security advisor, John Bolton, called him a national security threat.
I think Republicans, especially after the November 8 elections last year, see that he's poisoned to the ticket. He cannot be elected president. If he were the Republican nominee, he would doom our chances to get a majority in the Senate and the House. I don't think he's going to be the Republican nominee. I worry about the danger he can cause.
Is Trump a threat to national security?
I think he is. I believe that the damage he did during his term was significant but repairable. I strongly opposed him getting a second term because I worried that what he would do in a second term might be irreparable.
it's fair to say you continue to think about jumping in the 2024 presidential race, haven't made a decision, but it is something you are seriously considering.
That's exactly right.
And now to that comment about grip on reality, conservative columnist Charles C.W. Cook has a new piece for National Review entitled Trump Has Completely Lost His Grip on Reality. He writes in part this. Let's check in on the shadow primary for the 2024 Republican nomination. Nikki Haley is putting together a finance committee. Mike Pompeo has just published a book. Governor Ron DeSantis has continued to pick winning fights in Florida. And then there's Donald Trump, who, despite being the only candidate who has officially announced his bid, is, well, ranting like a deranged hobo in a dilapidated public park. Throughout his public career, Trump has resembled nothing so much as a drunken talk radio caller from Queens. And on Truth Social, readers get the treat of watching him at the zenith of his rhetorical powers. He can make numbers up. He can make numbers up off the top of his head. He can use hyperbolic analogies. He can do anything, anything that is, except focus on the world outside, where the problems that Donald Trump once used to propel himself into the White House remain real and pressing, whether or not he chooses to engage with them. Eugene, I doubt you disagree with this.
No.
And I think John Bolton talking about the danger that Trump poses to this country is a step. A number of other top Republican leaders need to follow. I mean, especially given the totality of what we're looking at on this show today, what we're remembering, where Joe is, you know, the big lie is a dangerous thing.
It certainly is. Yet we are concerned about whether the Congress, with its current makeup, with the Republican majority in the House, will continue to support the brave Ukrainian people who are fighting for their freedom, who are fighting on the front lines. Again, imagine if Donald Trump had been president when this war started. Imagine where we would be now. We would not be where we are. We'd be in a much worse place, I think. And he is a national security threat. He was a national security threat as president. He would be a national security disaster were he ever to be elected president again. And the one question I have about the piece that we cited is, what's new about it? I mean, he's been ranting like a deranged hobo in a dilapidated park for a long, long time. And many, many people have responded to that and follow his rantings. He's still the most powerful figure in one of our two major political parties. One hopes that power is finally waning. One hopes that influence is finally waning. And we could see the light at the end of this tunnel, but we're certainly not out of it yet. And so if, you know, he's the only announced candidate right now, he's the front runner for the nomination, and we'll have to see how this works out.
The man yelling in the park certainly is a vivid image, isn't it? Let's look into that question, Gene, of whether Republicans really are getting a wandering eye looking for someone else away from Donald Trump. The New York Times has some new insight into that this morning. Some members of the Republican National Party do appear to be backing away from Donald Trump. Dozens of members have expressed doubts about Trump's chances to win back the White House in 2024. And the New York Times reached out to all 168 RNC members and then interviewed the 59 who responded. Only 4 of the 59 said privately they support Trump. 4 of 59. While the others either flat out rejected him or spoke in favor of a crowded competitive primary field in the hopes of finding a stronger presidential nominee. So, Jonathan Lemire, we've said this almost every day in the last several months. You dismiss Donald Trump at your own peril. He's still, of course, a powerful force in the Republican Party. But if you get people on the phone, you talk to them privately, and even now some people publicly, they're saying there's got to be a better way in our party.
This is certainly the most political weakness that Trump has displayed since the morning of January 7th, 2021, where we are seeing Republicans for the first time in a long time talk about alternatives, suggest that he can't win again. And to be clear, his sin is not having dinner with a white supremacist or posting something ridiculous on Truth Social or even seemingly siding with Vladimir Putin by suggesting that Ukraine should abandon its war efforts. But it's about losing and the fact that he is blamed for the 2022 defeats in the midterms for the Republican Party, where they did not do nearly as well as expected. Now, I'll note that a crowded primary field might actually work to Trump's advantage because, yes, Trump definitely has a ceiling. And I think that's what Republicans are fearful about, that he can't win a general election because he has a ceiling of support. Well, he's also got a floor. We know he's got a base that's going to go with him just about anywhere. They have to this point. And the more candidates there are in the field, probably the better chance he has emerging victorious. Now, there are some cracks in the armor, to be sure. And we're even seeing Ron DeSantis, who has not yet announced his candidacy, pick someone else to be RNC chair other than Ronna McDaniel. That's a sign of perhaps him weighing in and saying that he's going to announce his candidacy yet. No one else has. It's an important stretch here for Trump, Mika. He's finally going to get back on the campaign trail. He's got a couple events going up. Can he silence these doubts or will they only grow?
Right. And one more note on all of this. Former President Trump's transportation secretary, Elaine Chao, is speaking out over racist comments Trump consistently makes about her. In a social media post on Monday, Trump tried to baselessly claim Chao was connected to the Biden classified document case. In his post, Trump used a nickname centered around her ethnicity to describe Chao. This is at least the sixth time Trump has used a racist nickname to describe the former transportation secretary. This is a woman who worked for him. In a statement shared with NBC News condemning Trump's attacks, Chao wrote in part, "When I was young, some people deliberately misspelled or mispronounced my name. Asian Americans have worked hard to change that experience for the next generation. He doesn't seem to understand that," which is a whole lot more about him than it will ever say about Asian Americans. And coming up, we'll be joined by a newly appointed member of the House Oversight Committee. Congressman Daniel Goldman is our guest. We'll ask the New York Democrat how he plans to counter the Republican extremists on the panel. And up next, we return our focus to International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Joe will join us from the gates of Auschwitz. And the head of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, will join us as well. Morning, Joe. We'll be right back.
It's very scary because of what's going on, and I hope the government is going to be strong enough to get rid of the hate groups. I don't know how they're going to do that. In the last few years, they increased, and I don't understand why there could be people who get together just for the purpose of hating different people. I mean, it's like a club just to hate. It's unthinkable, but it's happening.
That's a survivor of the Holocaust, Erica Gold, speaking about a recent rise in anti-Semitism in the United States. Let's bring in now someone working to combat that hate, CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt. And Jonathan, you know, there's so much to say about Auschwitz, about the museum set up here, but Jeff Kapnis, producer here, said, you notice even on this day, on this sacred day, they keep the museum open. People are walking in out of these gates. And I read a quote. You said, each and every one of the 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust had an individual name and story. Some will never be known. Those we do know must be remembered and passed on to future generations. How wonderful that this museum stays open to do that. And that you continue the fight, that you can continue every day. I'm curious your emotions on this day.
Well, Joe, this is a hard day. This is a hard day for me as the grandson of a German Jew whose family's ashes are in the buildings behind you, who lost everything and everyone that he ever knew in Auschwitz. his family, his friends, his life. This is a hard day for Jews around the world because so many of us, unfortunately, still bear the scars because we lost loved ones. And we still, you know, it's kind of an epigenetic suffering, Joe, to think about Hitler's campaign, this systematic effort to annihilate the Jewish people across countries, across continents, to exterminate and incinerate them. And I must say, it is deeply, as hard as this day is, Joe, it is incredibly meaningful to see you there. It's meaningful to think that a program like Morning Joe is spending the time to memorialize those we lost and to learn from this unspeakable tragedy. There are lots of ways you could be spending your Friday. To spend it there at those gates, I think, sends a message to your viewers and sends a message to the world that never again, it starts with never forget. And this is, I think, what you're doing as part of that process.
Well, Jonathan, the reason we're here is a reason that tracks with what you and I talk about far too often on this show, and that is the rise in anti-Semitic incidences. They shot up 30% from 2020 to 2021. We don't have the stats in yet from last year, but they continue to rise. Some of the biggest music stars, some of the biggest sports stars, as we know, the ex-president of the United States, the de facto leader of one of the two major parties in this country, as Gene Robinson said last segment, is trafficking in anti-Semitic tropes. And we found, sadly, that words have consequences. And we report on it, whether it's in a synagogue in Pittsburgh or whether it's in a college dorm room in Los Angeles.
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful for that. And you pointed out some statistics which really bear consideration. That stat of the number of anti-Semitic acts last year, harassment, vandalism, violence. Joe, it's the highest number the ADL has ever seen. The level of anti-Semitic attitudes in America, we found in a recent study, nearly doubled from 2020 to 2022. I mean, it's staggering. And you have to understand that anti-Semitism is a kind of conspiracy theory, a twisted, warped view of how the world works that centers all the suffering on the Jews. We see it from religious extremists. We see it from political extremists. We see it from, you know, extremists on the far right and on the radical left, whether they're positing that it's the Jewish people who are to blame or the Jewish state is to blame. So in this moment today, when we're seeing this rise of hate, this spread of scapegoating and stereotyping, it demands that all of us, Jewish or not Jewish, exercise constant vigilance and commit to education. So indeed, it never happens again. Because, you know, Joe, it starts with the Jews. It never ends with the Jews. The ashes behind you in Auschwitz encompass, yes, 6 million Jews and millions of Catholics, Poles, LGBTQ people, Roma people, and others who suffered simply because of their identities. So anti-Semitism isn't just a Jewish problem. It's everyone's problem, because it's a sign of decay that we can't afford not to address.
Well, and that decay comes in the form of anti-Semitism, but it also, the seeds of anti-Semitism are planted with conspiracy theories that you talk about. And many times the conspiracy theories aren't just about Jews. They're about so many other things. We have seen the truth being disregarded time and time again over the past 5, 6, 7 years. And can you talk about that? I've read one book after another about the rise of Hitler, about how ordinary people, Joe Biden is talking about ordinary people today who carried out these acts or who were complicit in their silence. How ordinary people were told lies. Ordinary people spread lies about just about everything. And soon it was the truth that was on the run. And that is what ultimately led to this. The big lie led to this.
There's no question. It, you know, as my friends at the Claims Committee have said, it starts with words. So when you hear people express the big lie, when they repeat fictions again and again and again, it is critical for other people in public life, whether they're elected officials or religious leaders or individuals like you do in the media, to stand up and say, no, this just isn't true, because it starts with words. And one of the lessons of the Holocaust, one of the lessons of the Shoah, is that we need to take tyrants' threats seriously. When Putin delegitimized Ukraine for years, for over a decade, and no one listened, now, unfortunately, we see what he meant. When Khamenei delegitimizes the Jewish state, and he's done this for well over 20 years, we know what he wants to visit upon Israel. And so when people in political life, even in this country, like a former president, minimize, demean, diminish people because they're Asian American, because of where they're from, or because of how they pray, we've got to take that seriously. Does that mean that Donald Trump's the next Hitler? No, but it does mean that it starts with words. And when you are silent, you are ultimately complicit in the suffering that follows. So it's not about how you vote, Joe. It's about what you value. That's why it demands all Americans and all people of good faith stand up, speak out, and ultimately, Joe, just show up when they hear prejudice, anti-Semitism, racism, or any form of hate taking shape.
Jonathan, good morning. I'm thinking, as Joe stands outside of the gates of Auschwitz there, about a study that came out a couple of years ago that I think shocked a lot of us, where two-thirds of a younger generation had never heard of Auschwitz, something that's so seared in our minds from history classes, from movies, and just from wanting to understand what happened during the Holocaust. How do we do better on education so that we can live up to that pledge to never forget?
It's a great question, Willie. And, you know, my friends at the American Jewish Committee just released a study that suggests that half of Americans don't even know how many Jews died in the Holocaust. We think this number, 6 million, is etched on our souls. But again, it requires constant attention, constant renewal. So education really matters. Ultimately, I think education is the only real antidote to intolerance. So we need to see Holocaust and genocide education all over the country. You know, the ADL has a program called Echoes and Reflections that we developed with USC and Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Israel, which does a great job of educating young people about these issues. Look, there's new legislation moving on the Hill, thanks to Congressman Josh Gottheimer, Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, Michael McCaul, and Kathy Manning. It's bipartisan, the HEAL Act, which is about Holocaust education, to make sure schools across the country have the resources that they need. Truly, the only way we can build a barrier against the next genocidal campaign is to educate our young people and is to empower our elected officials to remember not acting again in the face of hate is a kind of complicitly, and history won't judge you well.
All right. CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, thank you so much for being with us on this important day. And thank you for what you do every day of the year.
Thank you so much.
All right. Mika?
All right. Welcome back to Morning Joe. You're looking at live pictures from the Auschwitz concentration camp, where today we are marking International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Joe Scarborough is joining us live from Auschwitz this morning. Joe, talk a little bit, if you could, about why you were there and what we're going to be seeing, what will be happening in the next few hours.
Well, we were just talking, obviously, with Jonathan Greenblatt. There has been a dramatic rise in anti-Semitic actions, acts, incidences across the United States. It continues to grow. And there's a permissive attitude, far too permissive among far too many people. But we spent yesterday in Warsaw and went to a memorial at a train station where 300,000 Jews were deported from Warsaw and shipped to concentration camps and killed. Saw remnants of the wall that held in the Warsaw Ghetto. The 80th anniversary of that uprising is coming in April. But inside the Warsaw Ghetto, 460,000 Jews either shot or again deported and exterminated. Saw a prison intended to stomp out the Polish resistance and anybody helping Jews, trying to save them from the Holocaust. So, the history throughout Warsaw, and it was gray yesterday like it is today, the history of this grim time hangs heavily over that city and over the country and over the continent, especially now with a war raging just a few hundred miles east of Warsaw, with a regime who lied up until the day before the attack. And I will tell you, I saw last night in a meeting at the ambassador's residence with your brother and also leaders across Warsaw and Poland. I must say, I saw a real gratitude for the United States men and women in the military, the 10,000 that are here. Real gratitude for a president and a Congress who are working shoulder to shoulder in a bipartisan way to work with this country. A country that was ravaged, obviously, by war, first by the Nazis and then by the Soviets. And a real gratitude that the United States has placed a permanent base. That word permanent, so meaningful for the leaders in Warsaw and of Poland, a permanent base. They see that American presence as a guarantee that something like what we've been talking about today will never happen again with the United States, Poland, and NATO countries standing shoulder to shoulder. Later this hour, I'm going to be talking to the second gentleman, Douglas Imhoff, who toured Auschwitz earlier this morning with your brother there. And very emotional for Doug. And anybody that knows his history, his family's history, understands why. We'll be talking to him about that in the next 30, 45 minutes, and we'll bring it to you.
All right, Joe. And of course, just to your point about the Polish people and the gratitude, you know, Ukraine is the front line in the war against Russia and the war over the safety of the world, really. Poles feel a painful kinship with Ukrainians, and it's why their front line has been quite incredible in taking in Ukrainians at the start of the war, millions of them in months. And the relationship with America has strengthened as well, the partnership against fascism, against evil. And again, you're being there today at Auschwitz on International Holocaust Remembrance Day is especially significant. And we look forward to your interview with the second gentleman. I know you have to leave and do that right now. So we will see you again a little bit later on in the show.